Welcome to the Brian Kane Peak Performance Podcast. On each and every episode, Brian talks with coaches, athletes, and performers in all arenas who are putting into practice the principles of peak performance that will help you close the gap from where you are to where you want to be, to help you become a master of the mental game, and to help you start dominating the day.
Well, welcome, listeners and members. This is Paul Knickerbocker bringing you a live teleseminar interview with peak performance coach Brian Kane. We are extremely fortunate to have someone of Brian's caliber with us tonight. He has helped coaches, players, and parents at every level to achieve peak performance, from youth leagues on to the professional ranks. Please welcome Brian Kane. Hi, Brian.
Paul, how are we doing?
We're doing super, Brian. Hey, listen, I could go into all the things that you do, but I probably would leave some things out, and I would hate to do that. Could you share your extensive background and current involvement before we get to our members' questions?
Yeah, I sure can. I guess where it all started was, you know, at Mount Greylock High School in Williamstown, Massachusetts, which is in the northwest corner of Massachusetts, where I was a three-sport athlete, baseball, basketball, and football, and had the opportunity to get a baseball scholarship and go pitch at the University of Vermont NCAA Division I in Burlington. And while I was there, you know, I was a guy that was 86, 88 out of high school, you know, had a lot of expectations going into college and just couldn't get out of my own way. I was a guy that had a great work ethic, had a great attitude, was a great teammate, but was a classic example of a guy who grew up in a small town and only developed a fastball. And, you know, to the point where in Division I college baseball, when you give up a base hit, you try to throw harder, you start getting hit harder. So I was real frustrated and sought out the help of a sports psychologist, which was really good for me. I ended up having a shoulder surgery my junior year, which ended up being the end of my career. And while I was rehabbing from that injury, I came across the book Heads Up Baseball by Ken Revizza and Tom Hansen, and just fell in love with it. July 4th, here I am in Boston, and I'm 21 years old, and I'm in a Barnes & Noble at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I can't put this book down. It was just something like it connected with me. And first book I probably ever read cover to cover, and emailed Ken Revizza and said, I loved your book. I'm going to graduate from college. Is there any chance here of me coming out there and doing a master's degree with you, getting involved with the Fullerton baseball team and learning, you know, this mental game? Because at that point in time in my career, I wanted to be a college baseball coach. And a couple months later, I got a handwritten letter back from Ken. 2 years, you know, a year and a half later, I'm out at Cal State Fullerton doing my master's degree in sports psychology and the mental game of baseball, and in the shadow of Ken Revizza, and he's my mentor. He's gotten me to where I am, and I learned pretty much everything I know, you know, from him. And at that same time, you know, that I was getting the classroom experience in the sports psychology and mental game with him, I had the on-field experience with the Cal State Fullerton baseball team, which we all know is one of the top programs in the country. So I really got to see firsthand how they took the mental game from a classroom environment, brought it out to the practice field. So went to the College World Series in 2003, was in the dugout when we were there. 2004, I go back to Vermont. I'm teaching high school phys ed and coaching. And then after my first year doing that, I got an athletic director's job. After a year of doing that, I took on a role as an adjunct professor of sports psychology at the University of Vermont, and have been doing that for the last 2 years, and also have the wonderful opportunity to travel around the country and speak at baseball coaches' clinics and work with some of the top college programs in the country. Some of the programs that I'm working with, you know, University of North Carolina, Wilmington, University of Maine, Texas Christian University, Vanderbilt University, who's currently ranked number one in the country. Had an opportunity to go up and speak with Coach Delmonico and the volunteers at the University of Tennessee, University of Maine, University of Vermont, and I've spoke at some clinics. Did a presentation with Ken at the National ABCA Convention this year down in Orlando. Spoke at the Wisconsin Coaches Clinic, the Pennsylvania Coaches Clinic. Spoke at Ron Wolforth's Ultimate Pitching Boot Camp a couple years ago, which I'm sure people are familiar with who are in this inner circle and are on this phone call. So I've been real fortunate to be able to go around, learn from some of the best, and do what I call get inexpensive experience. Take the experience from other people who are successful, who are where I want to go, and take that information and get it out to as many people as possible.
Awesome, Brian. Now, you surely didn't let the grass grow underneath you. As a matter of fact, You had mentioned you had worked with several programs, one of which was UNCW, did you mention?
Yeah, sure did.
That's interesting. My daughter's attended there, and I'm also here in Wilmington, North Carolina. So we have a lot to talk about, and I certainly don't want to waste any time and really want to see us get after it a little bit. So why don't we begin with some questions that our members pose to us. Are you ready?
Yeah, fire away.
Okay. Coach Kane, I get really nervous before I pitch. In fact, the whole day of the game, I'm nervous. How do I calm my nerves?
You know, I think the place where I would start there is, you know, what's the reason for the nervousness? What's the reason for the anxiety? But also, you know, if you're when you say nervous, what are you experiencing? What do you mean nervous? Probably what it is it's more of excitement because the kid gets to compete and he confuses nervousness and excitement. And all it is to me is really a perspective change. I say you get the butterflies in the stomach, all you've got to do is get him to fly in formation. And, you know, the whole day of the game, it's one of those things where he's probably, you know, thinking about the game the entire day. And what I would encourage him to do is part of your preparation process, excuse me one second here, and as part of your what I call the hourglass of focus, how you get yourself prepared to play. You know, when does the game actually start? Does the game actually start when you throw pitch one? Does the game actually start when you get to the ballpark? Let's say if you're a college guy, you're getting to the ballpark at 4 for a 7 o'clock game. You know, at what point does the outing start? And if it starts, let's say you get to the field and you're doing your batting practice thing, the whole thing. Once you put those spikes on, once you tie up the spikes, that is your cue that my pitching performance is starting right now. And if you don't have that physical thing that you do that says, I'm now starting my outing, I'm now turning on to become the ultimate pitcher, guess what happens? You start thinking about the performance way too early. You burn up all the adrenaline. You freak yourself out because you start overanalyzing everything. And a lot of that happens because we don't have a system in place where we say, this is when I start the game. The second thing I would encourage is part of the pre-pitch routine, having that solid deep breath. And as a pitcher, you know that the deep breath is something that you take in between every pitch is part of your routine. And I've got video clips that if people are interested in, they can, you know, get a hold of me and I can get those to them. They're available in our inner circle of guys like David Price, who's the All-American pitcher at Vanderbilt, and some other pitchers, Jason Windsor, Troy Percival, guys taking that solid deep breath as part of their routine. Now, a lot of coaches have said, Brian, you know, we know the importance of breathing, but I want my guys to be able to breathe when it's 3-2 bases loaded. Game on the line. Well, for the coaches out there listening to this, guess what? If you want your guys to be able to breathe in the pressure situation, they first got to be able to breathe in the quiet, controlled environment. And that's why all the pitchers and athletes I work with, I give them a specific relaxation CD that they take that CD, they listen to it as they're going to bed. It helps them to focus on their breathing. It does a couple things. One, it helps them get a much more relaxed recovery quality sleep. And the second thing it does is it triggers the brain and the body to now recognize, okay, when I start taking good deep breaths from my belly, I'm supposed to slow my heart rate down. I'm supposed to relax. So that they do that in the quiet, controlled environment, and then when they do it on the field, or when they do it when they're taking a test, or they do it anytime they get in that adverse situation in their life, the deep breath triggers the body, slow down, relax, you're in control. And for the people listening to this interview, Paul, the first person that sends me an email to brian@briancanebaseball.com, I will mail one of those relaxation CDs that I'm talking about for free. So first email to brian@briancanebaseball.com. We'll get that CD, Relaxation and Recovery Training, for free.
Don't miss out, listeners. Brian, you talk about being nervous. Can you think of it as a signal that something important is about to happen? And I think quite often sometimes kids, players, tend to think of it as a negative situation. And then they get mental fatigue. And so what you're explaining in terms of breathing and relaxation, I think is right on the money to keep mental focus.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I think that the biggest thing is for the kid to just understand, or the athlete to understand, if I get butterflies or if I feel like I'm nervous, guess what? That's a good thing. That means I'm prepared. That means I'm ready to compete. I'm ready to go. Where at the same time, if they don't get those butterflies, they don't get that nervousness, then they feel, hey, I'm relaxed, I'm ready to go, I'm in control. So you got to get the athlete to understand and take the perspective that either way, whether they feel relaxed or laid back or they feel nervous and have those butterflies, both situations can dictate that they're ready to perform, they're ready to compete. The athlete just needs to understand and get in tune with the awareness of how they feel, and it doesn't matter how they feel, they can still compete very, very well if they get into playing one pitch at a time in the present moment. Because when you play pitch by pitch in the present moment and you get that focus on the here and the now, guess what? Nerves or too relaxed or all that stuff just disappears because you're so focused on what's important now, win, which is an acronym for what's important now, this pitch, this at-bat.
Sometimes it's uncomfortable is being comfortable.
Yeah, you know, that's a big thing. Big thing. Lou Piniella had the great quote. He said, you know, talking about a certain player on one of his teams when he was managing in the big leagues, and he said, this player will never be successful until they learn how to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. And that concept and that language that a coach can use with his players, hey, guys, we need to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. And then what we do is in practice, we practice in situations that are uncomfortable. For example, in an inter-squad scrimmage, you have your third baseman and shortstop switch gloves because now they got to get comfortable being uncomfortable using someone else's glove. And guess what? You're always going to have your glove in a game, but what we're doing is we're simulating that psychological same type of thing of, okay, I don't feel great. Maybe the person has a little bit of an injury, or maybe they're a little sick, or maybe they're 0-for-5 that day. Well, guess what? You still got to compete pitch by pitch, and we simulate that using the different glove. Or for example, if a guy's throwing a bullpen, we'll go down and have 4 or 5 pitchers stand around him and just heckle the crap out of him, get all over him. Because we're trying to simulate that environment. I mean, so many times you go down and throw a bullpen, it's like you're in church. Everything's quiet. No one's down there. Don't talk to the pitcher. Ooh, don't say anything to him. He's working. He's throwing his bullpen. BS. Try to get in his head. Get on him. Say stuff at him. I tell you this story about Ron Eastman, who's the head baseball coach at the Woodlands High School down in Texas. Won the 2006 National High School Baseball Championship. Had a great pitcher. First-round draft pick by the name of Drabeck, first name, Kyle Drabeck. His father, Doug Drabeck, used to pitch for the Pirates, great Major League Baseball pitcher. And one of the things that Kyle experienced as a junior is when they went to the state tournament, he's now pitching in front of a big crowd. People in the stands are getting all over him. You know, he's one of the top-rated pitchers in the country. You're overrated. You'll never be as good as your dad was. Cut your hair. You're ugly. All the stuff. And it really affected his performance. So going into his senior year, what Coach Eastman would do is he would pull kids out of detention, he'd pull kids out of the dugout, wherever he could find them. And any time Drabeck was throwing a bullpen or an inter-squad scrimmage, he would have the guys getting all over each other. So that when they got into that championship environment, it was almost like taking a step back. This is too easy. These guys think they're heckling us. We get on each other worse than this. So you practice those crazy type of environments.
Oh, great point. In fact, I spoke with the same coach going back on a shuttle to a flight in St. Louis, Missouri, where I was speaking, and I happened to see him, and I noticed two huge rings that looked like napkin holders. And I said, who are you? And he gave me his name and told me that. And I said, are you the coach from Woodland, Texas, the number one team in the country? And he said, yes. And I said, wow. Well, I gotta pick your brain here. Being a high school coach myself, I said, what is the secret? What is the magic to your success? He thought about it. He mentioned some drills and, quite frankly, some of the drills that we do and I've heard about to some degree. But what he really said that really hit home was, you know, you talk about simulate to stimulate. Well, he did a lot of that. He would practice game-like situations and do a lot of scrimmaging to make it as game-like as possible. So I thought that was really, really interesting when he shared that, along the same lines as what you're saying. And I love the idea about changing gloves, making them feel somewhat uncomfortable. You know, nervousness, sweaty palms, rapid heart rate, you know, that could be fear, but it could also be excitement when you go out with your first date, as all of us remember. It's the same sensation That's how we perceive and interpret that. So, very good.
You know, there are a couple other things I think, Paul, to throw in there for the coaches listening to this about the importance of quality practice. Some other things that we've done at Cal State Fullerton and some of the other programs that I've had an opportunity to be a part of is right in the middle of practice, BP or inner squad, whatever it is, the coach will blow a whistle and everyone runs in. Someone gets on the mound, somebody gets up to the box, runner at third base, infield defense, and it's suicide squeeze. You got to throw a strike, the bunter's got to get it down, we got to get the out at first base, and the guy's got to score. And it's right on the nose, or we'll do a hit and run. It's just basically an execution drill because you never know when it's going to happen. So it comes in. If they execute, we go back to practice. If they don't execute, they do a little bit of running, then we go back to practice. And it's another way to catch guys off guard and do exactly what you said, simulate to stimulate. Love that concept.
So you're putting them in athletic chaos. Great.
Exactly.
Question number two. The other day, I was pitching really well. In the fourth inning, I gave up a home run, and then I lost it. How do I recover from this?
You know, I think there's a couple of things you can do. One is, hey, you need that. Whoever, if this person is listening to this interview, they need to go home, and they, if they're there right now on a cordless phone or probably on a cell phone, go to your bathroom, fill up your bathtub with, you know, it's got to be between 80 and 85 degree water. Other anything other than that, it's not going to work. 80 to 85 degree water, fill it up about 3 inches. Take your shoes off, take your socks off, and then step into the bathtub. Now, if this pitcher gives up this home run, can step into that tub and stand on water, then they're allowed to be pissed off, beat themselves up, get frustrated because they are perfect, they can walk on water, and they should never give up home runs. But if this pitcher is exactly like anyone else who's walking around on the earth and steps into that tub and steps through and hits porcelain, well, guess what? You are not perfect. You are a human being, and you are going to give up home runs. And the longer you play the game of baseball, the more you're going to give up home runs. So what? Deal with it. Now, how do you deal with giving up a home run? Well, you have a routine that you go through. You give up a home run, you get off the mound. You get down on the grass, you beat yourself up, you get frustrated, you go to your focal point as part of your release. We always talk about flushing the toilet. You go to your release, you take a couple good deep breaths, and then when you're ready, you turn around, you turn your face back towards home plate, you get the ball, and when you're back in green lights, you get back up on the mound and you attack the strike zone. That's how you got to have a relief. You got to have something that you go through. It's the same thing when an umpire misses a call, when a teammate makes an error. What is your predetermined release that you're going to go through? And for the people listening to this call, first person that sends me an email, again, to brian@briancanebaseball.com, I'll send them a DVD on the mental aspects of pitching, which goes over all of these releases and exactly how you handle giving up a home run. I think the other thing that pitchers can do is they can go through an imagery process. And a lot of times when you do imagery, you want to see yourself making good pitches. And why is imagery important? Why is imagery a skill that elite-level athletes are doing that a lot of other athletes and coaches aren't doing because they're not aware of its benefits? Let me take you through an example and not tell you, but show you why imagery is important. So for the listeners on right now, what I want you to do is I want you to close your eyes. And I want you to, I'm going to talk you through a little movie. And I want you to play that movie in your head. And I want you to experience yourself walking into your kitchen, opening your refrigerator door, and taking out a lemon. And you take out that lemon, and you put it on the counter. And now you reach into the drawer, and you take out a nice knife, butcher knife. You cut that lemon in half. And then you grab one of those halves and you cut that lemon into quarters. And see that yellow, dimply skin and see that inside belly of the fruit of the lemon. Now you grab one of those quarters of lemons. You bring it up to your mouth. You take a nice, big bite of that lemon. and you feel those juices just go squirting right into your mouth. And now you pick up another piece of lemon, and you bite into that lemon and feel those juices just go squirting right into your mouth. Feel that sourness, feel that taste. And now open your eyes. And for the people listening to this, Paul, maybe you experienced this as well. How many people had a physiological response where their lips kind of and their face kind of puckered up like they were biting into a lemon? Did you experience that?
Absolutely. Yeah. My mouth was watering.
Now, why does that happen? The reason that happens is because the brain processes information that we vividly imagine and that we physically do in very similar neural pathways. So, why is imagery important? Why is that lemon experiment relative to what we're trying to do on the baseball field? Because as a pitcher, you want to put yourself in those situations. Yeah, you image yourself being successful and making your pitches, but you also image yourself overcoming adversity. You image yourself 2-2, throwing a great backdoor curveball, umpire screwing you. And you coming back and making the same pitch and the umpire punching the guy out. You image yourself giving up a home run, going through your release, getting the ball from the umpire, getting back up on the mound, and attacking the zone with an inside fastball. You go through that process in your head so that when you get onto a field, you know what to do. It's like deja vu. You've been there before. And that's where most athletes fall short of their potential, is that they don't take the time to go through the imagery process. And for anybody that's listening to this, next email I get, I will give you, I'll mail you an imagery CD for pitching. And if you request, I'll send you one for hitting as well. It's Brian at BrianCaneBaseball.com.
Fantastic. I know that every ball player experiences difficulties and obstacles and adversity. It's a game of failure. You're considered successful if you fail 70% of the time as a hitter. You're a Hall of Famer. So sometimes you have to look at it as losing the battle, but not the war. And so with your imagery, and if you would, Brian, you mentioned something about green light, traffic light analogy. Can you briefly explain what that might be about?
Yeah, for sure. You know, we talk a lot about in athletic performance as very similar to driving a car. And when you drive a car, and this all comes right out of Heads Up Baseball. This is Ken Revizzo, 101, again, who I spent 2 years with and continues to be a great friend of mine, and I continue to learn from him. And talking about driving a car, you come to a green light, what do? You just go. I mean, there's no thought process whatsoever. You just keep driving. You come to a yellow light, though, what do? You either slow down, you speed up, depending on who you are. You check the approaching intersection for traffic. You check the rearview mirror for a police officer. And then you go. And when you get to a red light, you better stop. Because if you don't and you keep running through red lights, eventually you're going to get in a car accident and get killed. So in a baseball performance, it's the same way. What are green lights? I talk about thoughts and feelings and experiences. What are the thoughts you have when you got green lights in baseball, when you're playing really well? What most people say is, I'm the man. This guy can't hit me. No one can get this fastball by me. I dare you to get in the box. Let's go. I'm coming at you. That aggressive green light mentality. What are the feelings? I feel big. My chest is out. I'm confident. I feel like I'm the man. I'm in dial-a-pitch. I can see the ball. It looks like a grapefruit coming up there. And what experiences give you those? When I've had good preparation. When I'm playing against a team or facing a hitter or a pitcher that I've had success against in the past. Whatever those green light thoughts, feelings, and experiences are for you. And the first thing I do when I'm working with a team or an athlete is I explain the concept of signal lights. And I have the kids write down what their signal lights are. Because unless they write it down and then give it to you as the coach and you look at it and then you follow through with a discussion about it with the kids, you're just giving it lip service. And just giving it lip service is not good enough. The kid has to actually sit down, write it down, and conceptualize and understand the concept of signal lights. What's a yellow light? Well, the yellow light for me, Paul, is when I'm in the batter's box and my bat feels heavy, or the umpire screws me on a pitch, or I'm 0-3, or I've had 3 great at-bats, I've hit the ball hard, but I've hit it right at people, and I got nothing to show for it. Or a teammate of mine makes an error if I'm on the mound, or I throw a great pitch and a guy gets a blue base hit, or coach sends someone down to the bullpen to get warmed up. Whatever it is. What are my thoughts? What am I saying to myself? I'm saying, oh man, here we go again. I can't believe that guy missed that call. Are you kidding me? That was a strike. I can't believe this guy made an error. How many times? Why does this always happen to me? Whatever those are, and you ask the individual player, they'll understand right away what their green lights and yellow lights are. And then the secret, you know, and red lights basically are an extreme example of yellow. And if you can draw a spiral, what happens is the peak performers, your high-level baseball players, they play the majority of the time in green lights. All of a sudden, they get into yellow lights and they have that awareness. Then they have that release, or we talked about, you know, flushing the toilet to help themselves get back to a green. Now, I'll tell you this. Every guy in minor league baseball, I shouldn't say every guy, 90% of the guys in minor league baseball, when they play their best, they have the physical talent to play in the big leagues. However, most of those guys in the minor leagues don't consistently play close to their best, so they never get to the big leagues. The guys in the big leagues play well consistently. Everyone in pro baseball, Paul's got talent. If they don't have talent, they're not going to get there. So guess what? Talent in pro baseball means nothing because everyone's got it. What it comes down to is the 6 inches between your ears and who's going to be able to take what they got and go do battle consistently and play well consistently. And that's largely a part of the mental game. And the athletes, they have an awareness of when I go from green lights to yellow lights, either on the mound or in the batter's box, and then have a process and a routine to go to help them get back to green lights so they don't throw away the pitching outing or don't throw away the at-bat, are the guys that are consistent and are consistently successful and make it to the next level.
Wow. You mentioned about the intersection, the yellow light. Most players, coaches, would speed up in that situation, but in athletics, you would probably need to slow down, take your deep breath, learn to relax so that you can execute to the best of your ability.
100%. And you know what's amazing is you mentioned that. I've got a video clip. One of the top closers in college baseball right now for the guys who are on that scene is a kid by the name of Casey Weathers at Vanderbilt University. He was a closer and a pitcher for the Team USA team this summer. And I've been fortunate enough to have the opportunity to spend some time with Coach Corbin and Derek Johnson, the pitching coach down there, and their team. And they're doing some of the best stuff in the country. I mean, if you're a coach and you want to learn, get to Vanderbilt because they're doing things the right way. And the thing with Casey Weathers is, you know, he was a guy who's just like you're talking about, when the garbage hit the fan and he got into those, you know, yellow lights, the tendency is to press. And there's three things you can go into when three P's you can go into when the garbage hits the fan and you get into yellow lights, and we'll cover those in a second. But what Casey's now doing is he's taking, you know, one, two, sometimes three deep breaths between each pitch when the pressure's on. I had the opportunity to see him, to work with him the last 2 weekends in January. Saw him throw in the game against Pittsburgh. Comes in, I think it was a 1-0 or 2-1 game. Comes in 1-2-3-8. Comes out in the ninth, walks the first guy. Next guy squares around the bunt, hits him. Runners on first and second, no outs. I'm looking on, what is he going to do? Is he going to speed up? Because the kid throws 98 miles an hour. Is he going to try to throw harder? No. He took good deep breaths. He slowed the game down. He played at his pace, and he got the next three hitters out, got to save. The team got the win. Now, that's all Casey Weathers. I mean, you can explain it to him. He still needs to do it. And you know, I've taken my hat off to him. I think he's doing a tremendous job, as are the Commodores this year. But we talked about those three P's, and when people get into yellow lights, what happens to them? Well, the tendency is to do one of three things. You either become a primal pitcher, a prayer pitcher, or a perfect pitcher. And as you said, most guys become primal. They get the ball, adverse situation, just like Casey was in that time, runners on first and second. He wants to throw harder, big dog. Because when you're in high school, you can throw harder against 7 out of 9 guys in the lineup. Ball comes up in the zone, lose movement. They're not going to touch you anyway. But you get into college baseball and pro baseball, you try to throw harder, you get hit harder. So being a primal pitcher doesn't work. It'll work in high school, but guess what? It ain't going to be better than that once you get out of there. If you're playing in good high school baseball, it's not going to be effective. The second one people go into, I think most commonly, is they become the perfect pitcher. And they just try to nibble those corners. And you see this a lot with guys young in pro ball and young in college. They don't want to come over the plate, so they try to nibble ball one, nibble ball two, trying to be perfect. And then you don't see it a lot, but you do see some guys who become prayer pitchers. And they got on the mound and saying, I hope this ball doesn't get hit out of the park. Please be a strike. And they're just praying to try to get the ball up there and not have it get hit over the fence or not have it, you know, go right down the middle of the plate. So I think most pitchers go into primal when they're in yellow lights or when they're in red lights. And again, main concept here for people to take away is have something to go to, breathing, release, routines to get back to green lights, to give yourself the best chance to be successful. Because, Paul, you know what? The best team never wins. Best team never wins. The team that wins, Paul, is the team that plays the best. And playing the best, playing the best is about playing one pitch at a time, as many pitches as possible, nine guys holding onto that hose or holding onto that rope, playing in green lights. Tell me something. You look at the movie Miracle. Classic example. You know, if they played 100 times, the Russians probably would have won 99. Herb Brooks said it. 10 days before the Miracle on Ice, the Russians won 10-3. It could have been 20-3. But guess what? That one night, that one day, the U.S. played better. The Russians were still a better team, but the U.S. played better. And that's the team that's going to win, is the team that plays better.
Very powerful stuff. I'm going to go to my next question. I know the answer to this based on the comments that you've already made, but basically the question is, I heard a coach say that you are born mentally tough. Is that true?
Absolutely not. And I'm trying to refrain from using profanity here. No, absolutely not. I hear people say it all the time, this guy's a mental midget, this guy's born mentally tough. BS. You are not born mentally tough. You are either mentally trained or not mentally trained. One or the other. You either have a great memory. I mean, you either have a trained memory or an untrained memory. You don't have a good or a bad memory. You're not either smart or stupid. You're either educationally trained or uneducationally trained. It's the same thing with the mental game. The mental game and confidence, relaxation, routine, responsibility, these are all skills that can be learned, just like putting down a drag bunt, getting a base hit, throwing a good curveball. And for coaches that say, well, you know, this guy's just born mentally tough, or this guy doesn't have it. Well, you know what I say to the coach? Then I say, you're a lousy coach, because you're not willing to put in the effort and take the time to learn the mental game so that you can then train your kids to get the most out of their ability. If you're going to write a kid off and call him a mental midget, then why do you expect your kids to give you a great effort? Because you're not demonstrating the effort by learning the mental game and getting better yourself. It's about being mentally trained. And coaches, any coach in the country can have a mentally tough team. I mean, being mentally tough is like being strong. You can control your strength if you get in the weight room. A great quote that I heard that hangs right in the weight room at the school that I work at. It says, there is no substitute for strength and no excuse for a lack of it. And I'll say there's no substitute for mental toughness and no excuse for a lack of it, because it's something totally within your control. And Paul, there's not a lot of things you control in the game of baseball, man. You can't control your size. You can't control your physical giftedness. You can blame your parents if you don't have that. You can't control your schedule, can't control the weather, can't control the umpires, but you can control how you choose to respond to all that stuff. You can choose to control your level of mental toughness, and you can control your levels of physical strength. But most people fall short of their goals, Paul. And a lot of that is because they don't know where to turn to get the mental toughness training. And that's my mission. That's what I'm trying to do, is take the mental game of baseball and bring it to people in information and in ways that they can take and they can use. And that's what my inner circle is all about, Paul. It's people that get into the inner circle, get interviews with great coaches, great players. They get videos, they get articles, they get email access to me. They have an entire mental game training program they can take and use with their team. It's the same program that Vanderbilt and Cal State Fullerton and TCU and UNC Wilmington and Maine and Vermont and all the programs that I come across with, it's the same thing they're doing. It's not secret. It's out there. People just aren't aware of it.
Why reinvent the wheel when there's success? You know, you use memory aids as I do, the acronym M-ABLE. And basically, it's all those things that you've just mentioned about being in control. You can control your mistake response. You can control your attitude, your behavior, your learning, and certainly your effort. And everything else, quite frankly, is a waste of energy and time.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And for Kevin Gustafson, who's out there right now, getting that pitching imagery CD, Kevin, I need an address from you. Email me back.
Awesome, Kevin. Good job. You'll love it. Brian,
yes.
Another question from our members. Does positive thinking work? Now, I have to laugh at this question. I've been trying to think positive about my pitching, but I still can't seem to pitch my best. Help this young lad out, please.
Well, you know what I say, I say this all the time. I say, guess what? We live in a negative society. I mean, Paul, you tell me. When you ever bake a loaf of bread before?
No, I'm sorry. I can't say that I have.
Okay, well, I'm sure you've bought a loaf of bread before. And you know those two pieces that no one wants to eat? What do you call those?
The ends.
You call them the ends. Some people call them the heels. Some people call them the butts. You know what I call them? I call them the beginnings, man. I've never seen a loaf of bread that doesn't have two beginnings. Most people call that light in the middle of the street a stoplight. It's a go light. It tells you when to go just as much as it tells you when to stop. Most people call that thing they wake up to in the morning an alarm clock. Alarms scare people, man. Alarm goes off when there's a fire truck going down the street. Alarm goes off when there's a bank robbery. I call it an opportunity clock. Because that day you get an opportunity to wake up and get better at the game of baseball. So does positive thinking work? Well, I'll tell you what. Positive thinking doesn't let you do anything, man. I mean, come on, if I tell you right now that all of a sudden my roommate walks in here having a heart attack, I'm going to be able to save their life. That's not going to happen, man. I don't know CPR. I can think I know CPR, but I haven't done the physical training to know that that person's in trouble. I mean, I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night, but you know that ain't reality, man. I mean, it's not going to help you. So think of this. Positive thinking doesn't let you do anything well. But it will let you do everything better than negative thinking will. I'll say it one more time. Positive thinking won't let you do anything well, but it will let you do everything better than negative thinking will. I'm a huge proponent of positive thinking, but people are confused about positive thinking. What positive thinking is telling yourself what you want to do, not what you're trying to avoid. For example, Paul, for the next 10 seconds, do not think about a pink elephant. Where does your attention immediately go?
How can I not think of the pink elephant?
Right. So that's, you know, positive thinking is telling yourself what you want to do, not what you're trying to avoid. For example, if I come out to the pitcher's mound and see this kid and say, hey, man, whatever you do, don't hang a curveball to this guy. You hang a curveball to this guy, he's going to hit it out of the park. Don't hang a curveball. I pat him on the butt. I go back to the dugout. Guess what's going to happen next pitch? He's going to hang a curveball. So as coaches, we've got to think positive. We've got to tell him what we want him to do. Hey, man, this guy's a good first pitch curveball hitter. You're a darn good curveball pitcher. Bury this thing down in the zone. Put it in the dirt. He's going to swing over it. Let's go. I believe in you. Or as a hitter, you're up at the plate. If you're 0 for 5, instead of thinking about, oh, man, don't strike out here. Don't strike out. Just put the ball in play. No, that's a negative mindset. Think positive. Or should I say think productive. Think, okay, this guy's going to try to attack me outside. I'm going to drive the ball to the right side. Or as that pitcher, he's trying to think positive about his pitching. Well, what are you thinking? Are you telling yourself what you want to do, or are you thinking about what you're trying to avoid? Tell yourself what you want to do. Second thing with being positive. Most people view failure or negative performances. Let's say this guy has a bad outing. Most people view failure as an event, you know, as a person. I mean, failure is something that happens. You deal with it. And in baseball, you got to learn to handle failure real quick because it's a game of failure. You succeed 4 out of 10 times, you're going to the Hall of Fame. I mean, tell me another job where if you succeed 4 out of 10 times, you're any good. I don't know of any other one. But what happens is failure becomes positive feedback. It's a difference as Tom Osborne, the football coach at Nebraska, and Skip Bertman, the baseball coach at LSU, they're always talking about the difference between winning and success. And winning is something that's an end result of doing things the right way. And you can't control winning, so let's not talk about it. Let's talk about success. And success is getting better every day. So you can go out and play, and you can lose, but you can learn a great lesson to help you get better. You can go out and have a bad outing or get hit around a little bit, but learn, hey, I fell behind in the count. I got down 2-1, 2-0, 3-1, and I had to put the ball over the plate, and that's why I got hit. So your failure, your bad performance becomes positive feedback because you learn from it and you get better. Now, if you learn from it and get better, does that really make it a bad performance? Does that really make it a failure? No. You can continue to get better, and that's the secret to success.
Right on. Failure's not a person. It's fertilizer. It's feedback. You know, a lot of kids, I think, equate self-worth to failure. What a mistake that would be. Talk about mentally tough players, Brian, have the ability to turn pressure into pleasure. Brian, based on your success and experience, how do you make players find their threshold or their breaking point, which everyone has? Some have it in a critical moment, some have it when there's just a little bit of pressure, but yet you still have to instill confidence to a player. How's that delicate balance? How do you see that unfolding, or how do you develop that, finding the threshold and yet instilling confidence?
Yeah, that's a great question, Paul. And where that comes back to is simulating to stimulate and having that quality practice and making that intense environment in practice. Because what happens is your kids and your athletes will never be able to outperform their self-image. They'll never be able to do something in a game that they've never thought of and internalized beforehand, either through imagery or through practice. So you talk about the breaking point. Well, you know what we're going to do is we're going to find that breaking point in practice because we make practice so intense. Comes back to John Wooden, the great UCLA basketball coach. If you read his book, A Lifetime of Observations and Reflections on and Off the Court, it's a quick read, fantastic. He talks about in an interview with Bill Walton and Kareem, they say, practices at UCLA were so intense, so fast-paced. Coach Wooden demanded so much of us that when we got into games, it was like the game slowed down. And that's exactly what I'm trying to get coaches to do with the mental game. And if you jump into our inner circle or you check out the Masters of the Mental Game, there's interviews with 50 coaches around the country talking about how do they do that? How do they find that breaking point? How do they simulate those yellow and red lights in practice so that when kids get into a game, they have an awareness and they know what to do when those situations come up? Now, where you see the breaking point most times, Paul, is when kids, let's say they get to Omaha, Nebraska, right? First time College World Series. And whoa, 40,000 people, big environment, different stage, stressed. Or for the high school coaches, listen to this, it's that state championship that we usually play in a college or minor league park. So here's an easy-to-use activity because I'm all about the practical, all about the applied. You know, I'm not a big textbook research guy. I want things that you can take and use instantly. And here's one of them that talks about quality practice and breaking point. Take a 2x4. Put the 2x4 down. What's that?
I'm sorry, man. You, I think that really separates you from the rest. The ability to transfer your activities and your thoughts into real game-like applications. I think that's what really sets you apart from many others because, quite frankly, there's a lot of information out there about the mental game. I'm sorry, continuing your thought.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, I appreciate that compliment. And you know, that's been my training. You know, you talk about as a coach, you're basically a combination of the coaches that you've had the opportunity to play and coach with. And I'm in the same boat. I'm no different. I've just been real fortunate enough to have worked with some of the top coaches in the country and taking that information and beg, borrowing and stealing and trying to make my own and get it out to other people. But that exercise that anyone can use is take a 2x4. Put it on the ground, have all your kids walk across it heel to toe. They won't think twice. They'll walk right across it. No big deal. Now, you take that 2x4, you suspend it maybe 5 feet in the air across two tables or across two benches or whatever. And now you task your kids, okay, step up on this bench and I'll walk across this 2x4. And the first, or on a windowsill or something. The first kid will jump up and he'll be like, whoa, this is different. And before he goes, you say, oh, hang on. Hey, Paul, tell me. You're now going to walk across this 2x4 5 feet in the air. Is this any different for you? And he'll say, well, yeah. Well, why is it different? Explain. Well, because now I'm 5 feet in the air. If I fall, there's a greater chance of me getting hurt. I'm not right on the ground. You know, the 2x4 is up in the air. It's going to bend a little differently. And I say, well, Paul, really think about this, though. Take a couple deep breaths. Bring yourself back to the present moment. And let's really think about this. This 2x4 you're walking across now, 5 feet in the air, isn't it the exact same 2x4 you just walked across on the ground? And they'll look at you and say, yeah, it is, coach. So, well, tell me something. Then why is the task any different? Physically, is the task any different? No, it's not. What's happened is it's the perception of task. It's that pressure of the task. Now I'm walking on a 2x4 5 feet in the air. It's the difference of, you know, practice indoors if you're in the Northeast, or, you know, for high school, any kind of, you know, practice or college practice. That's like walking across that 2x4 on the ground at most places because it's real laid back and easy. Where you put that 2x4 up on the ground, up, you know, in the air, now that's playing in a state championship or playing in that big game. What happens is the surrounding environment changes. The task doesn't change. It's still 60 feet, 6 inches, 90 feet to the bases, man. But our perception changes. So we do that activity. We write on that 2x4. Right. In Omaha, we trust. Or in Vermont, the state championship is at Centennial Field. In Centennial, we trust. And we do that activity. We take that 2x4. We paint it our school colors. And it goes everywhere with us. Is that reminder that we walk across the 2x4 every day the exact same way. It doesn't matter if it's a practice indoors in the gym or if it's a state championship. We play our brand of baseball one pitch at a time. We get after it with a game-like intensity every single day. There is never any stepping up. Because if you try to step up in a state championship, guess what? You get the tight ass, the brain starts going too much, you're going to suffer. You do not step up. If you're going to step up in Omaha, Nebraska, Mr. College Baseball coach or player listening to this, why the hell don't you step up right now and practice? Why didn't you step up in January? Because there is no stepping up. It's the same game, same thing every day. You play the ball, you play the game. You don't play the other team. It's like as Carl Lewis, the great American sprinter, said, I didn't become a great runner until I learned to run in my own lane. At Cal State Fullerton, we didn't become a great team during the 03 season until we started to play the game in our own dugout.
What wonderful stuff, Brian. I want to ask you another question here, and I guess my thought is it relates to coaches, parents, and also players. And typically, most of these different groups would recognize the flaw but don't necessarily comprehend the cause. And sometimes we ask ourselves, are we feeding the wrong need? You talked about a pitcher. Let's use the pitcher, for example. He's having some command problems, or he's throwing a flat breaking ball. And all of a sudden, that flat breaking ball or that pitch that he can't quite locate gets hammered. Now the question is it a physical, mechanical flaw issue, or is there some mental distraction or interference management issue going on? And I think, Brian, maybe you would agree with this. Do you find that usually a mental, emotional cause of a physical error occurring?
I'm sorry, Paul. I broke you up a little bit there. I had another call coming through. I didn't exactly hear your question. Could you repeat it, please?
Okay. We were talking about coaches, parents, and players typically. Most of the time, they recognize the flaw but don't comprehend the cause. And gotcha. I asked the question, are we feeding the wrong need? For example, pitchers have command issues, or they're throwing a flat breaking ball that all of a sudden they wonder why it gets hammered. Now, is it a physical, mechanical, technical flaw issue, or is it more of a mental distraction management issue? Do you find, Brian, that usually a mental, emotional is the cause of the physical, mechanical error?
Yeah, okay, I understand. Yeah, totally do. And I think where you see that is you'll see a pitcher whose front side is flying open. And now the parents and the coach are getting frustrated because they spent all this money sending this guy to Tom House and Ron Wolforth and all these big name, you know, pitching guys, and they got all the DVDs, and the guy's front side keeps flying open. Keep your front side closed. Keep your front side closed. Well, you know what? The problem isn't the front side. The problem is that the kid has put so much pressure on himself because he's gone to see all these pitching gurus and he should be successful that he pitches the majority of the time in yellow lights, doesn't have any awareness of that concept to slow the game down internally for him so that those yellow lights manifest in that front side flying open. So the emotional or mental issue of the game speeding up for that pitcher manifests itself in the physical mistake, in the mechanical breakdown. And a term that I use all the time, Paul, is I say prescription without diagnosis is malpractice. It's malpractice. And if you're going to go in and you're going to keep telling kids, man, you know, mechanical, fix this mechanical, fix this mechanical, fix this mechanical, but you never ask the kid the right questions and you never understand what that kid's thought process is, you're given a prescription without the proper diagnosis. You don't know what's going on inside of that kid's head. You're going to keep working against yourself. And we had a question that came through from one of the listeners that I want to make sure we address from Vic. So whenever we get the chance, let me know and we'll take that on.
Sounds good. Go ahead, Brian.
Okay, Vic's wrote in. He says, I have an 11-year-old son that's been pitching for a couple years. What would be the best piece of advice or exercise you would give a parent on how to both mentally prepare in a bullpen session to get prepared? You know, I'd say the best part about the mental skills, Vic and Paul, is that mental skills can be learned. And mental skills are the same thing. Whether I'm working with a 9-year-old or an 11-year-old or a guy that's got 10 years in the big leagues, the mental skills are the same. The experiences are the same. Kids who are 9 years old and guys that pitch in the big leagues for the first time and they're playing Little League in the first time, they both get anxious. They both get nervous. It's kind of manifested the same way. How do you handle those situations? So in talking about the preparation process, how do you make a bullpen more game-like? And there's a lot of articles on our Inner Circle website that, you know, with great guys like Ron Wolforth, the athletic pitcher, and Mark Calvey, pitching coach at South Carolina, Dave Serrano, former pitching coach at Tennessee and Fullerton, now the head coach at Irvine. We talk just about this stuff. And some of the things we do is we evaluate every bullpen. Instead of going in and just throwing 50 pitches or 40 pitches to a catcher in the same spot, I have a pitching chart that's available on the website for download. And you can sit there and you sit behind and you grade every pitch. Comes right from Long Beach State, where they'll throw a bullpen and they have, let's say you're trying to throw a fastball low and away. One of the charts you have on your piece of paper has an area on a graph for the low and away fastball that's shaded gray. And if the pitch is in that area, you put an X. You know, if you put an X on the chart, if it's in that area, then you put an X in the gray spot. And at the end of that 50-pitch bullpen, you evaluate what percentages of your pitches were in gray. What percentage of your pitches were where you tried to throw, that your process was accurate. We can never control the end result. We can never control what happens once that ball leaves our hand. But we can control where the ball is going. So one thing, evaluate the bullpen. Two, make the bullpen competitive. If you're throwing 40 pitches, break it down into 4 10-pitch innings. He's got to throw, let's say, 60 or 70% quality pitches, meaning where we're trying to throw with location. If he doesn't do it, he goes and runs, you know, 3 pulls, gets back up on the mound, throws the next inning. So there's a consequence, which makes it a little bit more game-like. There's a little more pressure. Now, once your kids are a little bit more advanced, I'd build in some distractions. I'd build in some music. I would talk to them while they're throwing the bullpen and let them try to, you know, get so focused on throwing this pitch that they don't hear you anymore or that you just become noise. Other things I would do would be, you know, structure your bullpen so that every time you throw, there ought to be somebody standing in. I mean, I get sick and tired of going to some of the top college programs in the country and majority of high school and below, and the guy's throwing a bullpen and there's no one standing in. I mean, come on. When are you ever going to throw a pitch where there isn't a batter in the box that it means anything? You never will. So whether it's a garbage can or it's a bench that's on its side, you know, whatever it is, put something in the batter's box so that the pitcher gets the live look of someone standing in there. Because what happens is if they throw all the time with no one standing in, now they go in a game, the pressure's on, it's a different look, yellow light. So that's a couple things. And I think with, you know, the 11-year-old and even younger, the earlier you can introduce these concepts, you know, it's like when they're at that age, they still have that learner's mindset. They want to get better. Once they get to high school and sometimes college, I think they know everything. You know, so the earlier you can get to them, the better they're going to be. And what I've tried to do with the pitching DVD is, you know, and Vic, I'll send you one, so email me your address, is allow these kids to see routines and see bullpen sessions of great pitchers. Another thing I would do for practicing for pitching is imagery. We call it shadow work. I remember I'm sitting at Cal State Fullerton behind the screen doing a chart. We're playing Long Beach State. Jared Weaver, who everyone knows, who just blew up this year in Major League Baseball, was fantastic, is pitching against us on Friday night. Totally dominates. Well, Sunday morning we're playing, and Weaver is down in the bullpen in the second inning throwing, which, you know, he's doing shadow work. He's doing everything exactly right, but doesn't have a ball. He's got a catcher. He's got someone standing behind him, telling him different pitches, different scenarios. You know, I wasn't dialed in on that stuff yet, so I thought he was actually throwing to get ready to come in the game. I mean, two innings he's down there throwing, then sitting down when they're hitting, getting back up and throwing. And I couldn't believe it. It took me two innings to realize that he wasn't throwing a baseball because he looked so game-like. But what Weaver was doing, and this comes, you know, right from Ken Revizza, who introduced this to me, is doing shadow work and throwing all the mechanics, the routine, the imagery, the catcher giving the signs, the sign recognition, all that stuff is exactly the same. And as you experience with that lemon experiment, by doing those things, you're programming the mind to be able to execute that, you know, to execute that pitch. If you can see yourself doing it with the imagery and you work on your pre-pitch breath and all that stuff, that's going to translate to the mound. Another thing, throwing your bullpen. You know, I see guys do this all the time where they're with the glove and they're giving fastball or giving curveball or whatever it is. Have the catcher give you signs. Have the catcher give you signs like there's runner on second base where he's doing the indicator. Because, you know, once you get in a game, man, if you haven't practiced that a lot, that can really slow you down and put you right into yellow lights if you're not 100% confident and comfortable with the sign recognition. One of those little things that we never really practice. I mean, you tell me next time you go watch when your bullpens, is your catcher giving signs or is the guy telling the catcher what's coming?
You know, Brian, great, great points. You know, people talk about bullpens and, you know, you're talking about making it as game-like as you can. And we wonder why kids get injured. How well do we prepare them in practice, in bullpen work, for the demands they face in a game? And I don't think we do a very good job with that. So all the things that you're talking about are crucial, not only from an execution skill, but also from a health, safety, injury prevention type concept as well. Listen, we can talk all night long, as I know you can. I just want to kind of wrap it up here, and I just want to make sure that our listeners are able to stay in touch with you or get in touch with you to get the proper information and purchase your CDs, your DVDs, and all the wonderful things that you have. So if you would, please make sure that they get that and any final thoughts that you may have, Brian.
Yeah, Paul, I think that, you know, the biggest thing, and I appreciate, you know, people calling in, because there's two types of people out there. There are knowers and there are learners. And the people that think they know are the people that are equipped to be effective in a world that no longer exists, because the world is continually changing. And the people who are learners are the people that are staying with the times and continue to get better. And we've made dramatic gains in nutrition, dramatic gains in technology of equipment, dramatic gains in strength training, pitching mechanics, you know, biomechanics, computer, the whole thing. The next one is mental game. And I think I'm on the forefront of that. And because I've had some great training, I've been a part of some of the best coaches around. And I want to share that information. So what I'm going to offer the people who are listening to this interview, and if they send me an email, so, you know, Vic and Kevin and some of the other guys that are on here, I'll email this to you as soon as we get off. I've got an offer where I've got about 70 products. I've got, I think, maybe 60 CDs or 50 CDs and 20 DVDs, just a total mental game package. It goes, you know, if you priced everything individually, it'd be about $1,500. For the people listening to this, I'm going to make an offer just for the people listening to this. For $400, I'll give you all 70 discs, and I'll have the email that has all that stuff in there. If there are certain things in there that you want, you know, if $400 is over your budget, email me back, and we'll see if we can make something happen for you. The other thing, we just have improved the website. Go to BrianCaneBaseball.com or BrianCane.com. They take you to the same place. People can get they can see videos of stuff that I've done on there. They can see some of the things that are going on. I encourage you to join the inner circle. It'll be about a 2 or 3 days here, and the inner circle is going to jump up to a next level where you get in there. You've got access to about 100 articles on the mental game. You've got about 50 ebooks from different motivational speakers and success coaches and peak performance coaches all across the world. I've got 50 interviews with college coaches on there that you can listen to. I've got a ton of videos and stuff that people can use. It's just a wealth of information. And, you know, the price structure will be up there tomorrow. There's different levels from anywhere from $10 to $30 a month, which gets you different access to the products and stuff online, also different access to me. And, you know, I always do a money-back guarantee. If somebody picks up one of my products and they don't feel like it helps them, they don't feel like it's worth it, I give them a full money back, no questions asked, because I stand behind what I do and what I believe in. And for people that want to call me, my telephone number is 802-487-3046. Again, 802-487-3046. Best email to get me at is Brian@BrianCaneBaseball.com. Again, Brian@BrianCaneBaseball.com. You know, I also do a lot of high school seminars. And for people that are interested, I know I've got some coaches that are emailing me now wanting to know if I can come out and do a seminar. Definitely can do that. And, you know, we can talk about that. And a lot of times it can be tied in not only for your baseball program, but I mean, one of my good jobs as an athletic director is I know we're always trying to provide coach education for the coaches in our athletic department. Talk to your AD. We'll come in. We'll do a coach's education on the mental game. Get him to pay for it, not your boosters, because you want to keep that money. And then I work with your team individually and extensively for the rest of that day.
Brian, outstanding. I just want to... I have a favorite quote, if you allow me.
Sure.
That I'd like to leave the listeners with. If you lick the lollipop of mediocrity, you will suck forever. And please allow Brian to lead you to mental excellence and mastery and take you to the next level. He knows what he's talking about. It's real. It's transferable. It's applied. It's practical. And if you want to commit to championship habits, you can't afford not to get some of Brian's outstanding material. So, Brian, with that, I just want to wish you continued success. We're signing off. This is Paul Knickerbocker and Brian Kane. Good night.
Thank you, Paul. Bye. Thank you.
Have a great one. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Brian Kane Peak Performance Podcast. Please make sure that you visit BrianCaine.com. That's BrianCaine.com. And sign up for my Monday message, where every Monday I deliver straight to your inbox videos, interviews, articles, tips, techniques, and strategies that you can use to master the mental game. You can also contact me through my website on our Contact Us page and see my calendar of where I'm going to be in the country and when I'm coming to your area so that we can get together and that we can continue to go out there and dominate the day.
The Brian Kane Peak Performance Podcast is part of the Top Coach Network. This is a production of Corn Belt Sports.